Welcome to the Voices from Afghanistan series, a five-part audio blog where we explore stories from Wisconsin veterans who served in Afghanistan from 2001 to the present. My name is Matthew Scharf. I'm joined by Rachel Halaska.
Hi.
And Tristan Krause.
Hi.
We are the summer interns for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Program. Thank you for listening.
The war in Afghanistan is the longest-standing military conflict in United States history, starting in 2001 and still going on today. In July 2016, the Obama administration capped troop levels at 8,400 service members. In June of 2017, President Donald Trump gave authority to Secretary of Defense James Mattis to reevaluate troop levels needed in Afghanistan as part of Operation Resolute Support. Given this development, we decided this was an appropriate time to look back at the historical record of this conflict.
All the segments in this series were taken from full-length interviews from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Collection. These interviews provide firsthand accounts and insights on the conflict in Afghanistan. This series will contain graphic descriptions and language that may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. This installment will cover Wisconsin veterans' interactions with Afghan citizens. We have incorporated stories from interviews with eight veterans ranging across several military branches and occupations. These clips include providing school supplies to remote villages in an attempt at winning hearts and minds, working directly with local elders and warlords, and forming friendships with Afghan interpreters.
In this first clip, John McNally, a Special Forces team commander, explains the importance of winning hearts and minds to create national unity and bolster support for the Afghan government.
In general, how are the Taliban regarded by the Afghanis? Are they the bad guys, or are they tolerated, or who's the good guys, who's the bad guys?
Generally, the Taliban are considered the bad guys, because okay. Some of the young interpreters working with us were put into jail because they didn't have the prescribed length of beard. And because of that, they didn't care too much for the Taliban and how much they infringed on their freedom, and they enjoyed it a lot more with Americans there and the government we were helping to establish. You know, they could shave. You know, they didn't have to have a length of beard where you can take a hold of with your hand.
How about women, huh?
Yeah, in the outlying regions, all of them were still covering up, and okay. You barely saw a woman. They keep them within the compound. The only time they come out is at night. It's strange. You don't see half of the population because the women are all locked up. In Kabul, the capital, there are a lot more women going around without the burqas on, and schools, you know, women's schools and girls' schools being established.
Next, you will hear from a group of service members discussing working directly with the civilian body. First, Robert Warren, a Marine with multiple combat tours, describes operating in an area sympathetic to the Taliban. Then, John McNally recalls a funny story about cooperating with village elders. And Michael Gourley, an Army National Guard advisor, talks about working with local warlords. Finally, John Samuels recounts his positive interaction with an Afghan general.
We had decided that, well, the company had told us that we were going to be establishing a platoon-sized patrol base. They told us to pick where to go. So he and I just picked basically the epicenter of where the Taliban was engaging us from. It ended up being a great decision to go there because it totally threw the whole Taliban command and control structure for that part of Marja out of whack. We built a patrol base there. The first couple of weeks were kind of hairy. They didn't want us there, so they were, whatever they could muster, they were kind of throwing at us to get us out of there. After a while, we started working with the local village elders and turning. This was September was when we really started making headway as far as turning that part of Marja around, turning the locals against the Taliban. And that was one of the things that platoon commander was very good at, was working with the locals and getting them on our side. But still fighting every day. And it was weird going from conventional infantry roles to switching gears to straight to counterinsurgency roles, to switching them again to almost political roles, where you're trying to balance Afghan egos and personalities and trying to give them what they want, but not give them everything. And it's a strange dynamic, trying to balance between the three. And then still taking heavy casualties and keeping the Marines focused and disciplined. We had zero civilian casualties on that deployment. And across the board, everybody I know was saying that, you know, if one of your guys shot a civilian, we'd understand. Like, they're not going to shoot a civilian. And they didn't. Realistically, it probably could have happened. I had good squad leaders and good team leaders to ensure that it didn't. But that platoon had, I think we had 19 Purple Hearts out of a 32-man platoon with six KIAs. Even regiment was floating the idea of pulling that platoon out just because they'd taken so many casualties. But the individual Marines had taken ownership of that AO. So pulling them out would have been even less popular. And once they started seeing the progress of less Taliban activity, people being friendlier, they kind of took ownership and kind of becoming part of the community.
How would you distinguish between a civilian and a member of the Taliban?
Well, early in Iraq, the Marine Corps started with basically five hard, fast rules. And one of them is treat everyone you meet with dignity, but always have a plan to kill everybody in the room. So that's kind of what we did. And especially due to rules of engagement, rules of engagement still weren't that bad on this deployment, but you basically had to wait until you could identify somebody shooting at you and they had to pose a threat to you or those around you. They got even more strict the next deployment, but in Marja, the guys were pretty good about being very judicious with their fires. We had no civilian casualties and, we did a lot of firing, and guys threw a lot of frag grenades and shot a lot of rockets, but still no civilian casualties. Across the board, it was one of those things that the platoon, the individual Marines made an effort not to injure civilians, to the point where they'd risk their own lives or their own safety to prevent an Afghan civilian from getting hit. It got a little bit difficult differentiating because a lot of the people in Afghanistan would have weapons. They would have an AK-47 or an Enfield or something like that. Even the E-2s and E-3s, they had to be able to identify, is this guy a threat to me, or does he just have a rifle because he lives in a dangerous place? So we usually wait for some kind of actual threat to present itself. Or if they had a machine gun, like some sort of crew-served weapon or an RPG, okay, yeah, that's a guy we're going to shoot right now. But, yeah, things started turning around in Marja, September, October. October, we're still fighting kind of regularly, but it wasn't every day anymore, so we're seeing progress. Starting to see construction projects happening in our platoon AO, having meetings with local elders and a lot of people showing up. The platoon commander or myself would get invited to village elders' houses for chai or for lunch or something like that. So things are turning around. November 2nd, Lieutenant Zimmerman got shot and killed. Platoon took it hard. I took it hard. So for the rest of the deployment, I was a platoon commander there and had to cook up a story to tell the locals on why Lieutenant Zimmerman wasn't around anymore, because we didn't want to tell him that he'd been killed or even wounded. But because I'd been working with the locals, it was kind of seamless. Didn't have any real problems with the locals. After that, I started going out on every patrol for at least the first couple of weeks, because you can see Lieutenant Zimmerman was the sixth casualty, or the sixth KIA, and you could almost feel the rage within the platoon. So I started going out on every patrol just to kind of temper that, make sure nobody did do something stupid. But nobody did. Continued along that course of fighting once in a while and focusing on building up the local governance and the village elders until we got relieved by 3rd Battalion 9th Marines and loaded up on helicopters and got out of there Christmas Eve of 2010.
But strangely enough, the couple of the elders, and I don't know how they heard about the miracle blue pill, but they really...
What was that?
Viagra. Somehow, I'd never asked, but my medics had some Viagra, and some elders were, you know, they'd kind of pussyfoot around it, I guess, a little bit initially, and they'd be, all of a sudden you'd see these Afghans, just kind of like little quirky smiles on their face, and they would talk to the translator, like they were asking about the pill, and you know, we use certain hand gestures, and like, all right, we know what they're talking about, and I never thought about it either. I don't know what the group medic was thinking when my medics were asking for supplies of Viagra through the supply chains, but you know, 12 guys in the valley, some desert valley, asking for Viagra, but it seemed to work, because we got some good intelligence from these elders, and they considered it pretty important to be vital, perhaps. Very important for them to be vital, and I guess a sense of their loss of manhood if they can't perform certain obligations. We helped them in that department, and they helped us with intelligence.
We used to go to the governor's house, the governor of Kandahar, for meetings quite often. And who would be there would be this mishmash that I kind of just described. The religious leaders, tribal elders, the politicians, obviously the governor of Kandahar, warlords, and everybody came with their own armies. So we would have gun trucks with us. So we'd have a lot of, you know, when we had our command element going in there, we had a lot of combat troops and Afghan soldiers being our security forces, as did the religious, as did the tribal elders, as did the warlords, as did the politicians. So all of a sudden, here you've got this huge meeting at the governor's house, and everybody's in there is armed. And not everybody's getting out there, they're shooting at one another. And here we're talking. And while we were in there, we had established quite a good working relationship, as I had described, with the special forces. And I was there with my commander, standing right next to him, ready to do anything that he, you know, that he felt I should do. And a lot of times when he felt a few things had to be going on, he'd send me to do part of it if it was talking with one person to get information while he did something else. And I was just waiting for him, you know, for anything he felt I should be doing. When the commander of the special forces in southern Afghanistan came up to my commander and handed him a piece of paper. And he took it and he opened it up and he closed it and he handed it over to me. And basically what it said in there, and I can't remember the warlord's name, you know, the name is lost to me now, but at the time he was the most feared warlord in the southern region. And it said that they had good intel that he was booby-trapping the various weapons caches and ammunition caches that we were out hunting down and blowing up. And therefore, that was putting, you know, that one of our many missions that was putting our soldiers at risk. So my boss, being as adept as he was at that Afghan culture, they wasn't going to take this moment and explain to me how he saw it. I just saw it through my less sophisticated eyes than him. And he told me to come with him. He told me to get our most trusted and best interpreter, who I got. And we went over and he approached this warlord. And he said through the interpreter, you know, he introduced himself and they, you know, the niceties and the formalities that you do under those circumstances. And he said to him very directly through the interpreter, pausing, you know, at the right amount of time, I'm aware I have become aware that you're booby-trapping caches in the area that we are disarming and blowing up. I want to tell you that if one of my Afghan or American soldiers is as much as scratched while we are fulfilling that mission, I'm hunting down your ass like a dog and pointed right at him. And I'm looking around me and I'm seeing all of these weapons and all of the, you know, these various groups, and I'm thinking, this is a powder keg. And once this thing blows up, I thought, what the hell are you doing? I mean, that's like going up to somebody pounding your finger in their chest, as I understood it, but it was not. He understood better. The warlord basically nodded at him, didn't say anything, just nodded and acknowledged what he had to say. Now, there were three or four people who had my commander's cell phone number, and I was one of them. And the Monday following this encounter at the governor's mansion or house or whatever you want to call it, he and I worked in one of these little bee huts, and our office was separated by a real thin piece of plywood. So we heard, you know, if the other guy farted, you could hear it in your office, you know, it was that thin. I hear his phone go off. Well, when his phone went off, there weren't a whole lot of people who had that number, so obviously I've got an ear up. And I was hearing things, and I thought, who the heck is this? Well, he finishes the call, and he comes in, and he says, you know who that was? And it was that warlord. And I said, well, I could hear your end of the conversation, but what was he saying? He said, I was the first American that he respected. Because everybody else would send a captain or a lieutenant out to give him messages, didn't treat him like a man. And I was the first American officer to treat him like a man. He took that as a sign of respect. And my boss was as sophisticated in that culture to understand that. So he actually started working with us as part of the demilitarization, and he became an ally. And that's the effect that my boss had in that entire southern region, his sophistication in understanding and dealing with those bizarre situations was absolutely tremendous.
And again, the best part about Afghanistan was dealing with the Afghans on a regular basis and seeing their culture. The people were good, but definitely a different culture. The general, can't remember his name, only spoke with the man once. He was given money to improve something on the base, something specific for his personnel. And instead of building a building or putting in new plumbing or something like that, he rented a backhoe and took this huge area of the base and churned it all up and ended up planting fruit trees, nut trees, and grapes. Now, the money was appropriated for a certain purpose. He used it for something else. In the United States, we call that corruption, and you'd be prosecuted. In Afghanistan, the way they look at it is, he was given the money to make the lives of his people better by growing fruit and nuts and grapes. He is going to make their diets better, which is going to make their lives better, and they can live in the crappy buildings just fine. They don't need a new building, but to improve their diet is going to make them healthier. They'll help their families, too. So that's not corruption. It's just doing his mission in a different way with funds that were meant for something else. But, you know, we use it over here. Thought that was rather novel. Not that I'd ever try it in anything I'm put in charge of, but I found it rather novel over there.
These next two clips highlight different experiences with Afghan children. First, John Vandeloup, a finance officer with the Army National Guard, discusses his unit's humanitarian work. Then Patrick Dahl, a Marine heavy equipment operator, describes a town they nicknamed Disneyland.
One of our goals at RC East was to win the hearts of mine. We went down there and our team chief said, you know, whatever else we do, we're going to get people to like us here because, you know, the hearts and minds thing, which I don't know if that term's in vogue anymore or not, but we really tried to work on it. We set up a network with our folks back at home that we had. Well, we gave out tons of shoes, coats, scarves, mittens, all winter long. It was one of the worst winters on record, by the way, for them. But what we would do is school supplies. We'd mentor our folks in the Army in the mornings and in the afternoons, and we'd take care of our, you know, we're responsible as well for our own military and taking care of all of our own pay issues and all that kind of business. But probably twice a week, we'd get the maps out and we'd find some little mountain village somewhere that looked remote, and we'd get our security forces, because after a few months, we did have security forces finally with us. Get a couple of up-armored Humvees to put on the front and back of our little convoy of Rangers, Ford Rangers. And we'd go to these little villages and, you know, get the village elder to come out, and we'd have a little discussion with them, and he'd get all the children to come out, and we'd do a shoe drop, or shoes were this big thing. What really hit us was that first, one of our first visits out to a small village after the snow fell, and all these kids came out. There had to be 50 kids out, and there wasn't a shoe on any one of them. And they're standing out there in this mud and snow and cold, and we just felt so bad. So that kind of became our push. And it worked. I said we got rocketed all along, but after a few months of that, the rockets became less. They didn't end, but it wasn't so intense as it had been. See, the Taliban would come in, and they would pay the locals to go up in the hills and set these rockets up. And they'd get a certain amount of money just for setting the rocket up, and if they killed an American, they were promised a whole lot of money. Well, we go out and spread this goodwill and win the hearts and minds, and we think, okay, maybe they'll think twice about going and setting a rocket up on us. We like to think that that's how it worked, and that was what caused us to be less of a target for them, I guess. But we did a lot of that. It was going well for the majority of the time, and I can't remember exactly when, but while we were there, the news hit about someone in Iraq desecrating a Quran. When that happened, we went out the next day, and it was like everything we did before that was for naught, because we could drive through the streets and we'd get spit at or stones thrown at us, or, you know, and it's like, okay, we got to start over. And we did. We kept at it. And to the very end, I mean, we had, like I said, we did tons of shoes and school supplies and things like that. So we'd interacted a lot with them. And that's how we went to this one village. They actually had a little soccer field up there where we always wondered, boy, because we played soccer with them a few times, you know, a bad kick and you're going a long way to find that ball down the hill. But yeah, we'd go up there and we'd set up a perimeter around the village. And then, you know, we could relax a little bit and interact with the kids and the elders. Never the women. The women never came out, but always the kids. And that's where I met that little girl that kind of took a liking to me. She came up, and the first time she came up, she couldn't have been 7, 8 years old, but only about yay tall. And the wind was so brutal that her cheeks were just blistered from being dry. And so the next time we went up, I had my wife send me some lotion, and took some lotion up there, and I showed her how to do it and put it on. And, you know, she loved that. And then pretty soon, you know, I think we probably visited her 5, 6 times. Every time we go, she'd come and find me. And it was funny because she would always want me to pick her up and hold her and walk around, carry her. And none of the kids ever did that anywhere we went. So it's a pretty sweet little girl, pretty sweet little girl. She asked, matter of fact, when we went up on our last visit and had the interpreter, you know, talking with her, and I said, you know, tell her I'm leaving. And she actually started crying, and she buried her head in my neck. And I kind of wonder how she's doing now. But the people are great people, just wonderful people. They really were.
Well, these little kids were just animals. They would steal, if it wasn't bolted down, they would steal it. The one little girls, they were always trying to sell these little bracelets. I don't know, some plastic stuff they dye with. I don't know what they used to. Little bracelets, you know, they'd sell you for $1. You could buy their little hats, their little Aladdin hats they'd have on. You could buy those from them. And they would sell you anything, and they would steal everything. You know, our straps on the trucks, we'd be taking anything. We'd put a box of MREs in the back between the bed of the truck and the cab. And these little kids, like, they could get up there with, in a flash, and they'd have a whole box of MREs off that truck, and they'd steal chains and everything. They stole our fuel, our filter caps for our air filters. They were just like, because we'd have to stop, because if we go by base, you know, the platoon commander would have to go in and kind of do his lieutenant thing and talk to people. So we'd be kind of a lot of the base was real small, so we couldn't actually go inside. And there was one place called Disneyland. They named it because there were so many kids. It was just notorious for the kids. I mean, they threw rocks. They left their own rocks. Mostly that's where they used to get some baseball players from. Those kids could throw. I mean, they'd be so far away. There's no way that little kid could throw a rock this far. Sure enough, your window, because that ballistic glass would shatter if they got hit by a rock. It wouldn't go through, but it would still shatter the glass. So they cost the government a few dollars just replacing glass like that. I can't really blame them. I'd probably do the same thing if I was a little 10-year-old kid running around Afghanistan, nothing else to do.
Lastly, Danny Zhang, a Husky operator with a Marine Explosive Ordnance Disposal outfit, talks about his relationship with his unit's Afghan interpreter.
We had an interpreter with us. Oh. And we had two Afghan Army personnel with us.
Yeah.
But one of them was, he stuck with us throughout our whole deployment. So we learned a lot about him and the culture. And then he learned certain things from us too, which... You know, it was against protocol to teach him a lot of stuff, but then, just have him watching cartoons or something with us on our iPads or iPods, just to show him that, you're not there for something else. You know, there can be friendships. But one of the Afghan Army guys, one of them kept getting rotated out because he had a problem with using hashish. Which is marijuana, or a strain of marijuana over there. He had a problem with using that around the platoon and inside the trucks and everything. So we had to rotate him out because it wasn't safe for us either. And then you get these little small size energy drinks, rippets. You would always trade those for whatever you needed, and that was pretty much currency out there.
If you or someone you know is interested in donating materials or taking part in a veteran interview, please contact the museum. If you enjoy listening to this installment, listen to our past installments and be on the lookout for additional installments in the Voices from Afghanistan series. Thanks for listening.